Podcasting Technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com. And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. It's Monday, July 23rd. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to help end marijuana prohibition in America. Legalization won't happen without your support, so make sure you join up today at norml.org. And we have Join Now links right up at normalaudiostash.com. This week is a very important one for marijuana politics on the federal level. Wednesday or Thursday of this week, depending on the floor schedule, we'll see the U.S. House of Representatives debate and vote upon the Hinchey-Raubacher Amendment. This amendment would protect patients from federal prosecution in states that allow medical marijuana use and access. The new House Speaker Nancy Pelosi represents the San Francisco area, and she was vocally in favor of the amendment last year, as was most of the California congressional delegation. Tomorrow on the program, we'll speak with the bill's sponsor, Congressman Maurice Hinchey of New York. Also, we'll speak with Aaron Houston, the Federal Legislative Affairs Director at the Marijuana Policy Project, about the bill itself and what kind of activity we'll expect to see on it this year. Stay tuned all week right here to Normal's Daily Audio Stash. We'll have audio of the floor debate from Congress and, again, interviews with Congressman Maurice Hinchey and Congressman Ron Paul this week. So make sure you get involved this week as well by contacting your local congressional representative and asking them to vote in favor of the Hinchey-Raubacher Amendment. We'll have links to contact your local elected officials in the Normal Take Action Center, and we have direct links to that right up at normalaudiostash.com. Don't wait another moment, folks. In our digital age, getting involved with politics is an email away. So get involved right now with links at normalaudiostash.com. On the Audio Stash today, we're going to cover a number of important marijuana-related news items that took place in the last 10 days. We're going to speak with two of our senior correspondents, California Normal's coordinator Dale Gehringer and Normal senior policy analyst Paul Armentano. Let's begin out in California with Dale Gehringer in the San Francisco area. Dale, welcome back here to the program today.
Good to be here.
Great to have you back here today, Dale, to talk about the news. Let's begin with a very prominent story regarding letters sent by the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, sent to landlords who are renting commercial properties to medical marijuana co-ops and facilities. You know, first, tell us about what was in the letters and the landlord's reaction to them.
Well, the letters, which were sent by certified mail, warn the landlords, in fact, that they are renting to somebody who is in violation of federal law, that doing that is punishable by criminal law and also punishable by forfeiture under federal law. By sending those notices the way they did by registered mail, it makes the landlords liable for forfeiture because they cannot claim to be innocent owners anymore. They can't say, well, I didn't know that these people were running a pot club because, in fact, they've been told it. So in that respect, it's a smart enforcement action by, and a cheap one, let me point out. Sending letters is a very cheap thing to do by the DEA. So it created quite a bit of panic amongst certain people in the medical marijuana community. We're told 120 letters were sent out, almost every one of them to the city of L.A. We list 180 cannabis dispensaries in the city of L.A. and then a bunch more in surrounding cities. So these didn't go out to everybody.
So this was strictly letters. There were no agents on the ground at these landlords' properties or homes or anything.
No, not at all. However, the next week they announced four or five medical marijuana indictments that had to do with other cases entirely that had been on the burner for many of them for years, in fact. So I think that sort of bolstered the message that they're on the prowl out there. But in no case did they initiate any forfeiture action. And in fact, there have only been a couple of instances since Proposition 215 passed that forfeiture actions have been tried. The most notorious, however, was, in fact, in the city of Los Angeles itself, shortly after 9/11, when they busted the Los Angeles Cannabis Resource Center, at that time the only medical marijuana club in Southern California of any size. And its building had been bought for it by the city of West Hollywood. And the feds actually successfully forfeited the city of West Hollywood's $300,000 investment in that building. That was 4 or 5 years ago, and we haven't really seen anything comparable since.
So have any of the landlords pulled their leases or pulled the contracts because of these letters?
First of all, it's not exactly pulling a contract because technically, if their tenants are in breach of the law, they can claim that that's a violation of the contract legally. Some landlords have kicked people out or given them polite notice. Others have taken a sort of more measured response on it. Some sort of view it as a more bark than bite. The severity of the threat sort of is tempered by the fact that under federal law, the forfeiture cannot be excessive or disproportionate under the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution. And there are cases, for example, there's one landlord that we heard from who has like a $20 million building that's got, 70 units in it. And one of the units happens to be a cannabis club. And he just sort of laughed at this whole thing because he can't be held liable for the $20 million building for one dinky cannabis club. The penalty would have to be more on the order of the amount of rent he was receiving from that club. So, as I say, there's varied reactions, and the reaction from the public in Los Angeles, and specifically the LA Times, which is not a radical leftist newspaper, was very adverse. The LA Times even opined that, if feds were going to go through with something like this, maybe they ought to, maybe the forfeiture laws ought to be repealed. It's questionable whether the DEA can really make good on this. They would certainly look terrible trying to do forfeiture without having some really bad club also being prosecuted at the same time. Just to go after the landlord would be I think...
Righto. Now there's been some important local level news out there in California as well. Santa Barbara's lowest law enforcement priority ordinance for marijuana has been upheld by a local court.
Yeah, there've been maybe half a dozen of these lowest priority ordinances that have been passed throughout the years here in California. This is the only one that was really subject to this kind of a court challenge where the city was trying to claim that somehow this infringed on their ability to set police policy, but the courts threw that out.
And also, Dale, what's happening right there in your area with the Berkeley medical marijuana vote?
Well, that had to do with an election of electronic voting brouhaha. There was a very close election on a medical marijuana regulation ordinance back in 2004, very, very close. And it was done on electronic voting machines, I think, for the first time in Berkeley. And then the city stupidly cleared out the voting machines, or not the city, but the Board of Elections did, shortly after the election, so it was impossible to do a good recount. And on those grounds, it looks like the court will order a new election.
And also today, Dale, just generally there in California, another county has put into place the card program, now making over 30 of the 58 total counties in California fully complying with state law now.
I must say they've been dragging their feet on it. In 2004, the state passed a law requiring counties to establish ID card registration programs. Here it is 2007, and still a bunch of counties haven't found it, and San Diego's still fighting it. But yes, Orange County, which had been dragging its heels, did vote for the state registration program, as it should be required to do under state law. People are finally coming on board on this kind of thing, and in fact, we had a further another similar kind of victory. Merced County, which has been a backwards county and originally sued along with San Diego County to try to resist having any card program at all, in a lawsuit that was launched a year or two ago, our San Diego affiliate, San Diego Normal, ended up getting being a defendant in this suit from the county of San Diego and Merced County, trying to resist enforcement of this ID card program. A lower court ruled against that, and since then Merced pulled out of the program, and just last week the Merced County Sheriff announced that he had established a policy that pretty much recognizes everything that we were asking for regarding the rights of patients not to be arrested, provided they have proper identification. Merced County is a pretty conservative county, so law enforcement has been gradually giving in on this thing, but it's been 10 years since we passed the law.
Indeed. And those DEA letters to the landlords in L.A., that really comes on the heels of this Hinchey-Rombacher debate this week. That federal law could largely curtail most of this DEA activity on medical marijuana in states like California that allow it. So is that letter-writing campaign and the like, is this the DEA flexing its atrophied muscles while it still can out there?
I think so. I think they see the writing on the wall. And, you know, people have often wondered, you know, why the DEA just doesn't try to sweep up all the clubs, which would be a pretty big operation out here and would antagonize an awful lot of people, to tell you the truth. But at this point, with only a year and a half to go in this administration, any such kind of action would be in the courts for years to come, to tell you the truth, and would not even be settled under this administration. And it looks increasingly likely that there's going to be a new policy coming along in the next administration anyhow. So I think that might dampen the Department of Justice's enthusiasm for going after this thing anyhow.
And also, Dale, what's the overall state of medical access in California right now? This is the state that has really led the way and continues to do so. So how many medical patients are there in California right now?
Somewhere around 200,000 or more, maybe 300,000. We think that based on what we see out here and based on surveys that have done in Canada, that potential medical marijuana usage by the public is probably on the order of 1% of the adult population, which is, you know, pretty substantial. And we see there are some areas up here where about 1% of the adult population are registered medical marijuana users for one of the other, you know, ills and complaints that that begin to plague people, especially as they reach my age. So, that's a lot higher than we see in other states that have more restrictive definitions of who is eligible to be a patient.
Now, we've seen New Mexico's program get authorized this year, and it'll be coming fully online soon, but the law in New Mexico calls for the state to essentially be the distributor of marijuana to the patients there. Has California's program been such a success because this dispensary model is the best method for access, do you think?
Right. Well, but it's sort of an ad hoc seat-of-the-pants method. This whole distribution system that has evolved here, these dispensaries, were never really, envisioned when we passed the law. We didn't even set up a distribution system in the law. We said that we instructed the state and federal governments to do it, and they sort of failed to do it, and for lack of action on their part, this other system has evolved. But it's sort of like the very similar story to the Dutch coffee houses, which also sort of evolved in a crack in the law. It's sort of similar to what's happening in Canada, actually, where the court struck down the Canadian law and said and instructed the government to come up with some sort of medical marijuana distribution system, and they fumbled around with it for years and have never really been able to come up with anything efficient, and instead they've had to rely on these compassion clubs which have just sprung up outside the law. It seems like the governments of the world are really hard-pressed to deal with legal cannabis at this moment. They're locked into this archaic prohibitionist system by international treaty.
And as we get set to cover the Hinchey-Raubacher Amendment this week, Dale, let me ask you what you think of this proposed federal legislation.
Well, Californians have a pretty strong opinion on this, to tell you the truth. It's a strong issue out here because we're seeing the brunt of the action, and you will see once again that two-thirds of our congressional delegation will vote for the Hinchey-Raubacher Amendment, but I sure hope we can get some support from other parts of the country. Because that's what we need at this point. California's gone as far as it can go without some support from the broader United States.
And I have to ask about Speaker Pelosi. She's your local representative there. Do you think having her as House Speaker this year could come into play favorably for the amendment?
Well, she did a lot for it last year. I would be surprised and gratified if we got a majority this time, though, to tell you the truth. There's still a lot of areas of the country where there are Democrats from conservative kinds of areas in the South, for example, who just are not very educated on this issue. And last I knew, nobody was really expecting to get a majority yet. Hey, and I hope people will call their Congress people and urge them to vote for Hinchey-Raubacher and to oppose the federal war on medical marijuana.
And we'll have links to contact your congressional representatives at normalaudiostash.com. Dale, thank you again for taking time to join us here today.
Thank you, Chris.
Dale Gehringer is the coordinator of California Normal. They can be found online at canorml.org. We have links to it on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Stay tuned. We're going to speak with Paul Armentano, Normal Senior Policy Analyst, about the NFL, sports, and marijuana, as well as the drug czar's recent reefer madness statements. That's coming up in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Is it 420 yet? This is Rick Cusick from High Times Magazine, and you're tuned into Normal's Audio Stash.
Next up today, we're going to sit down with Normal's Senior Policy Analyst, Paul Armentano, and discuss some very important news items. Paul, welcome back to the show today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Always great to have you here on the program, Paul. Let's begin by discussing this article you co-wrote with Normal's advisory board member, Mark Stepnoski, who played in the NFL for the Dallas Cowboys and won two Super Bowls with that team. This article appeared first in Reason Magazine online, then was picked up around the country, and really follows this connection of marijuana and the NFL, some certain players, of course, some of which were national news. Tell us a bit about the article here, and everyone can read the full text of it with links we have at normalaudiostash.com.
Well, the article that we co-wrote, actually, we began writing it several months ago when there was quite a bit of talk in the media regarding certain soon-to-be NFL players and some current NFL players that had admitted to using marijuana off the field. And there was quite a bit of debate within sort of the sports world of whether it was acceptable to have players in the NFL basically admitting to smoking marijuana when they're not playing, and because the NFL right now is facing a lot of what are known as character issues, and they're trying to establish a policy that isn't really quite specific, but a policy cracking down on players that they believe have bad character or poor character, and at times even suspending some of those players from the NFL, there were a lot of questions raised that should a player who admits they used marijuana in the off season or when they're not on the field, does that display poor character, and should the NFL then take some sort of penalty or fines against those players? And so we were talking about that issue and also talking about how we felt it was quite ironic that the NFL and many other sports leagues, they test players for their off-season use of marijuana while oftentimes looking the other way at many players' use of both performance-enhancing drugs and oftentimes their abuse of alcohol.
And, Paul, you made some distinctions there between the different sports leagues and their policies, notably the NBA. How do they differ from the NFL?
The NBA, I believe, and I'm not 100% up on this now, but as many people know, particularly a few years back, there was a lot of talk in the NBA that more than half of their players, including many of their top players, were cannabis aficionados, shall we say, and then that were well known for using the drug quite a bit during the season when they weren't playing, generally after games, things like that. At the time, I do not believe the NBA was even testing for the use of marijuana in their players' drug screening, and that was probably the result of the fact that the NBA itself, and certainly the players' union, was well aware that many of their most popular players were using marijuana. It didn't seem to be hindering their performance on the playing field, so why not try and look the other way that it was going on? I do believe that since that time, that more recently, the players' union and the league did come to an agreement where some players are tested for marijuana, but unlike in, say, the NFL, a positive test for marijuana, I don't believe results in any sort of game time suspension in the NBA.
And I'm curious, you know, working with Mark on releasing this, what was his take on all this after having spent some time in the NFL on a championship team?
Well, once again, you know, Mark has spoken, you know, quite candidly as an NFL player about sort of the pressures players are on, and certainly in the NFL and playing that schedule, you know, some of the pain they live in during the season. And, you know, he's noted that, look, you know, many players, when the game is over, you know, their knees hurt, their shoulders hurt, they're in pain. And, you know, many players, you know, they have the option, they could take, you know, some sort of analgesic painkiller type drug, but many players, not surprisingly, simply choose to use marijuana to relax, to be able to go to sleep, and to help ease their pain. And in fact, as long as they're not using it during practice or during games or right before games, it really is not the sort of issue that should raise to the level where the sports world or the media or even the leagues particularly coming down hard on it.
Very interesting. Now, this piece was picked up yesterday in the Sunday Chicago Times, so the public seems rather interested in the topic.
Yeah, most definitely. And, you know, I think while on the surface a story like this might sound kind of sexy because for some people, it might be surprising to think that some of America's top athletes also indulge in the use of cannabis. But really, if we're going to talk honestly in this country about marijuana and marijuana use, you know, the fact remains that even according to the federal government, nearly 100 million Americans admit having used marijuana at some point in their life. And the dirty little secret is when we're talking about that large a percentage of the American population, we're really talking about folks from all walks of life. Judges, lawyers, doctors, teachers, and most certainly top athletes. In fact, it really shouldn't be surprising at all, and it's really about time we begin discussing this issue honestly. And we have policies, including policies in pro sports, that simply reflect this reality.
And can these sports stories and attitudes hit closer to home? You know, I'm thinking of how we treat high school athletes and the like.
Well, you know, certainly the question of drug testing comes up quite a bit, whether we're talking about students, student athletes, or pro athletes in general. And while I do think, particularly for certain leagues, they have the authority to set the sort of policies, you know, as they wish. And certainly one can make an argument for drug testing in certain sports, particularly when you're looking for the use of performance-enhancing drugs, which can certainly very quickly make what would otherwise be a fairly level playing field no longer level. But marijuana, as we know, it would be awfully difficult to argue with a performance-enhancing drug. At the same time, it would certainly not appear to be a drug that in any way negates athletic performance. So a player's off-season use of it really shouldn't be an issue one way or the other.
Righto. Now, Paul, let's move into another very serious story here of absolute federal reefer madness propaganda and rhetoric. Last week, drug czar John Walters was in California. He called marijuana growers terrorists, which on one hand seems just as serious and equally absurd as calling someone a witch in Salem, Massachusetts 500 years ago. But let's put all this into perspective here. Where was the drug czar when he brought all this up?
He was in Shasta County, which is in Northern California, and he was there to kick off a multi-week law enforcement crackdown where they were going to go into national park land and they were going to uproot marijuana plots that had been growing on national park land. And Walters was there to kick off the campaign, and in his remarks he commented that, in fact, he believes that the folks who grow marijuana on public lands, in fact, are terrorists. And beyond that, he added that these sort of folks would also aid terrorists slip across our borders for the express purpose of causing September 11th-like mass casualties. And they were a very inflammatory sort of statement. There certainly isn't any evidence to back John Walters' statements, but they were picked up by the press, certainly in California and throughout Northern California, by most of the major papers. Very few, I might add, who actually questioned the substance behind Walters' accusations regarding terrorism.
And as we get into the presidential politicking season here, Paul, the drugs czar is presidentially appointed. So this is likely the last hurrah for John Walters and ONDCP chief scientist David Murray, who have both resorted to the basest lies and reefer madness propaganda for pot over the last 6 years.
Certainly one would hope that with a new administration we will have a new drug czar. Certainly if it's a new Democrat administration, one would believe John Walters would be very quickly given his walking papers, or he might simply resign on his own of his own volition for a job very poorly done. But, you know, the reality is while a new administration may bring in a different drug czar, unless our public policy in this country radically begins to change regarding marijuana, regardless of who the drug czar is, the rhetoric is going to mostly continue unabated.
Also, Paul, there was a story out last week making its way around the wires that showed up. The ONDCP reps, including Walters, were making appearances for GOP congressional candidates during the last election season and sort of engaging directly in politics, something that's a definite no-no for the ONDCP.
Sure, yeah. I've actually been surprised at how much of a media story this has been and how a number of political pundits believe that the ONDCP, a taxpayer-funded organization, really oversteps their legal and ethical bounds by, on, you know, the public's dime, essentially going out and campaigning for specific GOP candidates. I'm glad to see that this is beginning to turn into a public story, because as most people familiar with this issue have known for some time, while the drug czar is supposed to be apolitical, the reality is that the ONDCP and the DEA and some of these other federal agencies have really been involved in political campaigns now for years, mostly to thwart medical marijuana either initiatives or even legislative proposals at the state level. And that is not within their charter to do so. And it's about time they got called on it.
Again, this is something they are not supposed to be doing at the ONDCP, even though it seems like John Walters especially has made quite a number of political references and done what is hard to ignore as electioneering.
Yes, most certainly. And, you know, John Walters, from time to time when he has been questioned about this, you know, has tried to argue that, in fact, they are still fulfilling the guidelines of the Office of National Drug Control Policy by going into these states and telling reporters and trying to encourage the public to thwart these sort of efforts. But as I said, you know, this is supposed to be a nonpartisan, apolitical office, and clearly they have a history of picking sides in political debates, and as this recent flurry of activity shows, they also seem to be rather partisan when it comes to which candidates or which party they're willing to stump for. And once again, that is not within the rules with which they're supposed to follow by.
And finally today, Paul, if you, Paul Armentano, normal senior policy analyst, were asked by the White House to make suggestions for the ONDCP and how it was run, what would those suggestions be?
Well, you know, the agency was only created in 1988 by an act of Congress. And at that time, the ONDCP was only authorized to exist for, I believe, about 3 or 4 years, and they are reauthorized by Congress every few years. And the reality is I'd simply eliminate the agency altogether. This agency has only existed for less than 2 decades. There were a number of benchmarks that this agency is supposed to meet. It doesn't meet any of them. Matthew Robinson's terrific book, Lies, Damn Lies, and Drug War Statistics, far more articulately and comprehensively than I can, runs through the entire history of this agency and the goals it's supposed to meet and how it's never met them. But, you know, by its charter, this agency should have been defunded a long time ago by Congress for simply not meeting the goals that it's supposed to meet. Of course, as you know, most people are aware, unfortunately, this agency has no real benchmark and will continue to be funded regardless of the fact that it continues to fail in its mission. So, you know, I don't see a role for this agency. I think it's a waste of taxpayer dollars, and it's been a waste of taxpayer dollars since its inception.
Right.
I think it should be judged, you know, like any private entity would be. If you had a private business and year after year after year it failed to meet its objectives, it would be out of business. But because this is a taxpayer-funded business, it continues to roll along unabated, even though it has never achieved its stated goals, and there's no indication it ever will.
Righto, Paul. Well, this has been a great conversation of news topics here today. I really look forward to speaking with you frequently this week here on the Audio Stash as we cover the Hinchey-Raubacher Amendment. Paul, thank you again for joining us today.
Sure thing, Chris. Good to be here.
Paul Armentano is Normal's Senior Policy Analyst. You can reach him at paul@normal.org. We have links to the Reason article up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. And again, folks, stay tuned all this week for coverage of the Hinchey-Raubacher Amendment. Make sure you get involved today in Normal's Take Action Center. We have links to contact your congressional rep up at normalaudiostash.com. Make sure you send those emails right now. Stay tuned. We're going to round out the day with some comments from Normal's executive director, Alan St. Pierre, about presidential candidate Hillary Rodham Clinton. That's coming up next.
I don't think it's news that Mrs. Clinton is now stating publicly, for I think the third or fourth time in her run for president, that she is against the federal government raiding medical marijuana cooperatives and dispensaries in California. However, maybe I'm just a little jaded. Maybe it's simply her last name. Maybe it is her communitarian-like sensibilities on this topic that make me believe that she's going to be about as bad as her husband was on this issue. Her husband, Bill Clinton, and his vice president, Al Gore, regularly used to look into the eyes of AIDS patients and people suffering from serious diseases. Jackie Rickard in Wisconsin was an individual who had a chance to confront both Clinton and Gore when they were running for president in 1992 at one of their infamous bus tour stops, and they told her matter-of-factly that they would end the federal government's prohibition on medical marijuana, that they would expand the compassionate IND program from a then lowly 7 people. And they didn't either. In fact, 2 years after being elected, July 24th, 1994, President Clinton stopped medical marijuana in the United States effectively by stopping the compassionate IND program from admitting any more new patients to receive marijuana, like Irvin Rosenfeld or L.B. Musica or George McMahon. All of these individuals are now grandfathered into this program that President Clinton stopped. So, again, maybe I'm just a bit jaded, but I don't think that Mrs. Clinton is going to champion medical marijuana law reform in the United States. I think any politician, save for the idiot who is our current president, would try to arrest and prosecute sick and dying people out in California for using a state-approved medicine. But I am definitely dubious whether Mrs. Clinton would actually take a different tact.
That was Normal's executive director, Alan St. Pierre, commenting on Senator Hillary Clinton. Links to the full article about Senator Clinton's comments in New Hampshire can be found at celebstoner.com. We have links to that at normalaudiostash.com. One more reminder here today, folks. Get involved with the Hinchey-Raubacher Amendment. Full coverage this week. We'll be speaking with Congressman Maurice Hinchey, Congressman Ron Paul, Aaron Houston of the Marijuana Policy Project, and Paul Armentano of National Normal. Folks, make sure you get involved. Contact your congressional rep right now, today, via email. We have links to do so right up at normalaudiostash.com. That's a direct link to Normal's Take Action Center. Make sure you take action today. It's free, it's easy, and folks, it is effective. Don't wait another moment. We have links at normalaudiostash.com.
76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Strop, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.